Time for a little rejuvenation. NPR's Silvia Pagioli is going to take us away to the Italian region of Umbria. It's known as the green heart of the country, covered by miles and miles of vineyards. Winemaking in the region dates back to antiquity, when wine was known also for its therapeutic properties. And Silvia visited an Umbrian town where what was old is new again.
The medieval town of Torgiano looms over gentle hills lined with row after row of vineyards. Winemaking has existed here since the time of the Etruscans, and Torgiano hosts a unique museum that traces the central role of wine in the economy and culture of the Mediterranean world. It's the creation of Maria Grazia Lungarotti.
We all made wine more or less the way the Romans did until the Second World War. It all changed with modern machines and technology.
Maria Grazia is the widow of the founder of the Lungarotti winery, the biggest in the region. An art historian by training, she has collected nearly 3,000 items that illustrate how wine has accompanied mankind for millennia. In the museum cellar, there's an 18th century wine press which follows the design of the ancient Roman author Cato the Elder, a type of press still in use as recently as 60 years ago. The displays alternate between the sacred and the profane, ceremonial bronze pieces and glassware from ancient Greece, alongside medieval and Renaissance winemaking tools. A large section is dedicated to rare books, engravings, and apothecary jars, which illustrate the many uses of wine in medicine and cosmetics. And now, visitors to Torgiano have the chance to experience those old methods put into practice. It's called wine therapy.
Buonasera. Piacere, Manuela.
The vino therapy spa is called Bella Uve because Bella is Bella everywhere. In every language you understand the meaning, and Uve because it's from the grape.
Teresa Severini is the daughter of Maria Grazia Lungarotti and one of Italy's first female enologists. She says the idea of using wine for wellness goes way back.
Many centuries ago, where you can find recipes to have a good skin, good health. Still today, if you go into the country, you can find people immersing the legs in the wine when they are tired, or doing a massage on the scalp because of the good properties of wine.
Over the centuries, wine has been used as an antiseptic and a sedative to alleviate depression, hypertension, gout, and rheumatism. Recent studies suggest the compound resveratrol found in the skin of red grapes might have magical anti-aging properties. The spa has revived the ancient use of grapes and wine to make unguents, perfumes, and soaps applied with modern massage methods. Every treatment uses a specific wine for foot massages, facials, or body peelings. Masseuse Emanuela Menella starts filling a wooden tub that looks like a wine cask. As she adds 3 liters of Sangiovese red, she describes the treatment called the Wave of Bacchus.
We start the wine therapy with the scrub, massage with a cream with the wine, and after bath in a wine. After the bath in a wine, you feel energized because the wine activates the circulation, is antioxidant, and relaxing the muscles.
Menella says all the treatments are just modern versions of what a person like Cleopatra would have been accustomed to.
She did the bath in a wine, the bath with milk for moisturizing her skin. So we take the old treatment. Here in Umbria we have all product, all natural product. Why not use that?
Many of the treatments available at the spa derive from what in centuries past were known as books of secrets, books filled with beauty aids and remedies for everyday ailments written by women for other women. Silvia Pagioli, NPR News.
This is NPR. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A lot of the money that the federal government poured into its bank rescue program probably ended up overseas. That's the conclusion of a report issued today by a congressional panel overseeing the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. It says the government needs to do a better job tracking funds flowing to foreign banks. More now from NPR's Jim Zaroli.
Many of the major countries of the world took steps to rescue their banks during the financial crisis that peaked in 2008. But the report says the programs varied greatly from place to place. Countries like France and Germany rescued only the most troubled banks, most of which happened to do little business in the United States. But Elizabeth Warren, chairman of the oversight panel, says the U.S. government spread its net much more widely, pouring money into more than 700 financial institutions of all kinds. Warren says many of these had significant ties to foreign investors, and when the U.S. government gave them money, much of it essentially flowed overseas.
The result appears to be that America's rescue had a much greater impact on other nations than their rescue programs had on the United States.
Warren points to insurance giant AIG, which had to be rescued by taxpayers. The rescue enabled the company to make good on derivatives contracts held by European banks. Warren doesn't find fault with this. She says AIG probably wouldn't have survived as a company if it had tried to treat its overseas customers any differently than those in the U.S. And she says this cross-border flow of rescue funds is probably inevitable in an age of giant multinational banks. Still, she says, the U.S. needs to do a better job tracking where its rescue money goes.
If the U.S. had gathered more information about the flow of rescue funds, it could have asked other countries to share the pain.
Treasury Department officials responded by saying the TARP program was part of a globally coordinated effort that had helped stabilize the financial sector during a difficult emergency. And they said trying to determine how to apportion responsibility and make everyone share the pain would have been practically and politically impossible. They also pointed out that the bank rescue would probably end up making money for U.S. taxpayers. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Let's start with the good news. General Motors says it made $1.3 billion in the second quarter. That's way better than its first quarter profit of $865 million. And by the way, its CEO, Ed Whitaker, is leaving as of September 1st. A lot of people in the auto industry saw that second announcement as the bad news today. They worry that it's not good for GM and its initial public stock offering, which is just around the corner. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports.
At the end of an earnings conference call for analysts and media, GM CEO Ed Whitaker chimed in. His news? He'll turn over the CEO reins as of September 1st to GM board member Dan Akerson. Whitaker says everybody knew, including the board, that he wasn't in this for the long haul.
My goal in coming to General Motors was to help restore profitability, build a strong market position, and prepare this iconic company for success. Today, we are clearly on that path.
On the path? Yes, agrees Aaron Bragman, an auto analyst with IHS Automotive. But he's concerned that this change could really hurt GM, which has had three other CEOs in just the past year and a half, while it's recovering from a bruising bankruptcy, especially because GM is preparing to announce an IPO, an initial public stock offering, that will enable the U.S. Treasury to get at least partly out of the business of owning an auto company.
To announce this days before announcing the IPO, which is the ultimate goal here for restructuring GM and getting it back public again, is frankly bizarre.
Gerald Myers, a former CEO of American Motors Corporation, puts it even more bluntly.
It's a mistake.
Myers says the potential investors in GM are likely to be shocked. And whatever you do, he says, don't shock the investors. He doesn't care if Whitaker, a longtime Texas native who came out of retirement to run GM, wanted to get back to the ranch.
Once he took the job, he didn't have any choice but to see it through. And he is not seeing it through. And I'm disappointed. I know it. He isn't that kind of guy.
Many of the GM dealers contacted for this story today were getting the news for the first time from a reporter, and they weren't happy about that, nor about the change in leadership. For his part, dealer Richard Genthy says he's not worried. Genthy doesn't know anything about Whitaker's successor, Dan Akerson, a senior executive at Carlyle Group. But he's confident that GM is now leaner and more focused on making great vehicles.
This is the type of talk that I hear, talk that I hadn't heard before. So that all bodes very well for us, and I'm very optimistic.
Ed Whitaker will stay on as GM's board chairman until the end of the year. Dan Akerson will assume that role as well once Whitaker leaves. Meanwhile, analysts expect GM to announce an IPO within days. The success of that IPO will determine how soon GM can lose the embarrassing nickname, Government Motors. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.